And welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to Sarah Neath and Janice Folk Dawson, who are two representatives from the Guelph and District Labor Council, because if it's the end of April, then you know that it's time for the annual National Day of Mourning. Although the pandemic is over, COVID-19 did some good in the realm of raising the profile of workers' safety. From health workers to grocery clerks, there was a whole class of workers who during the pandemic had to keep working, and that meant intentionally putting themselves at risk. This was important. But even before the pandemic, workers across Canada in all sorts of work were taking risks every day, often unknowingly, and they still are. Raising awareness is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. According to the Association of Workers' Compensation Boards of Canada, in 2022, there were 993 workplace fatalities recorded in Canada. Among those deaths were 33 young workers aged 15 to 24. That's about three young people every month that go to work one day and don't come home ever again. Now, there are dangerous jobs in the world, jobs that can expose you to dangerous people or dangerous circumstances. But would you classify climbing a ladder under the category of dangerous work? Or perhaps performing the same task 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for a decade? Sometimes it's the little dangers that become big problems with high personal costs, and the implications rarely make headline news. According to lore, two labor activists were driving to a union meeting in 1983 when they were stopped for a funeral procession. The deceased was a firefighter who died in the line of duty. In other words, they died on the job. And our two labor activists were struck by an idea. Not everyone that is killed on the job is given this kind of remembrance. United Steelworkers in Elliott Lake held a remembrance day for workers who were lost to the effects of working in uranium mines there, which ended up providing the basis to create a nationwide commemoration for all workers lost on the job. QP passed a resolution first, and then there was the Canadian Labor Congress, and then the AFL-CIO, and then the Government of Canada, a conservative government, I would add, legislated the Workers' Mourning Day Act in 1990. And since 1991, workers in Canada stop every April 28th and remember colleagues hurt and killed on the job. But what do those issues look like in 2024? That's one of the questions that Sarah Neath and Janice Folk Dawson join us to answer on this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast. We will talk about the things they think about during the National Day of Mourning, the things they hope you're thinking about, and the things that they want people in power to think about in order to make sure fewer people die on the job. We will also talk about the rather startling statistics when it comes to people being killed on the job, why these deaths are not given as much consideration in the media as, say, deaths from crime, and how affordability plays into issues around worker safety. And finally, our guests will talk from personal experiences as Neath will discuss how helping workers through injury claims has affected her and her point of view, and Folk Dawson will talk about struggling as an injured worker herself. So I caught up with Sarah Neath and Janice Folk Dawson last week via Zoom.
Well, hello. My name is Sarah Neath. I am with UFCW Locals 175 and 633. We represent about 70,000 members across Ontario in every sector you can think of. And for myself, I work for the local and I am the coordinator and a workers' compensation rep. And we help the injured workers with their appeals through WSIB and the tribunal.
Janice Folk Dawson, pronouns are she and her. I am with the Canadian Union of Public Employees, QP. I am an injured worker, and I am one of the members of the Guelph and District Labor Council.
Okay, perfect. And I feel like I just want to put this on the record that I did not plan on talking to Janice twice in 2 weeks. That's just how the way it worked out. I emailed Nicole from the Labor Council and she said, I've got Sarah and Janice for you. And I said, okay, great. So that's the way the cookie crumbles. Let me get impressions from the two of you first. Janice, you're on my screen right now, so I'll ask you first. Every year when we come around to the National Day of Mourning, What are some of the thoughts that come to your mind?
It comes, first of all, there's two things that come to my mind is, first of all, how important it is for individuals to take action. And so the history of Day of Mourning is that, a rank and file union member took a resolution to a CUPE convention in 1984, saying that we should call a day of mourning for injured and killed workers in this country, and so that there was an awareness campaign with it. And a year later, the CLC, the Canadian Labour Congress, actually declared April 28th as the first day of mourning. And then you morph that into, by 1996, the international, the ILO declared it an international day. So, you know, the actions of one person have brought such attention to such an issue. And that's my second point, is that it is frustrating. I wish that we did not have to have these days. And as the, you know, this morning and over the last week, as I've been pulling out the stats of what it is, and it can't just get down to stats, but the stats are staggering, that they, you know, continue to rise, the number, and we're only having the stats of those that are reported. So I think that it is a day for me where I become empowered and try to figure out ways to get other people and our politicians understanding just exactly how important this issue is, and the how large and the numbers of workers that are being injured and killed in Canada.
And Sarah, same question to you.
Yeah, I mean, based on the work that I do, I mean, this is my everyday, you know, it's not just April 28th for me. But I think, you know, just not to repeat anything that Janice said, like, it to me, there's a lot of, I mean, you can put your health and safety hat on and talk about prevention. And because, you know, if I'm working on a claim and someone's injured themselves doing a repetitive job in a grocery store, you have to assume that anyone could have the same injury. So, you know, talking about being more proactive and going back into the workplace and saying, okay, this is how I got injured and how can we make it better for everyone? And we've seen some successes throughout the years with workers that have been able to go back and do that in their workplaces. But, you know, April 28th is just so, it's always in my mind, I guess. Like I said, it's what I do. And I think, you know, from a political perspective, it's just, we need governments that actually care to help assist with the runnings of the WSIB, to create better, you know, health and safety protection laws for workers, actually enforce the WSRAE law. We can probably talk about that numerous times throughout this conversation. Yeah, it's just because we just don't care. They're just getting injured and underreporting. And you know, to tag on what Janice said about underreporting, that is one of the worst. There's so much suppression of claims. You know, employers just saying, "Oh, go on short-term disability instead of going to WSIB," and then they get shortchanged on everything. And people are just terrified. They're terrified to lose their jobs, and they won't report. So, you know, again, the numbers are frightening and unacceptable, but, you know, thinking about how much more is out there is even more terrifying.
Sarah, can I ask you just when you're talking about workers making claims, you know, there is that obviously pressure from management, you know, because a long-term claim is ultimately more expensive for them than a short-term claim. But I mean, humans are humans, and especially when you're on the younger side, you have this feeling of indestructibility. Maybe you can just walk it off. Yeah. Do you have any idea sort of how much is one and how much of the other in terms of some of the claims you see?
I mean, that's my favorite injured worker line ever is, I thought it would get better.
Mm.
You know, it's just because it's not just the young. I would actually say it's more of the Gen X and baby boomers, because they have this very stoic work ethic, and right, they just want to keep working. And, you know, and as we all say, you know, you can have pain on the job. You know, sometimes it hurts. And as we get older, you know, we aches and creaks and pains, and it just it gets harder and harder. But I think, and yes, we can accept that. But I think at the end of the day, if it's actually work related, that's the reporting side we need to see. But yeah, it is tricky because again, people want to work at the end of the day, and we don't want people to lose time from work. And I personally don't care if it's causing problems for the premiums of the employer, but with return to work, the WSIB has a very firm, better at work program. Employers don't want to pay. But at the end of the day, we don't want workers to lose money either. We need them to mitigate their circumstances and make sure that they're not losing money at the end of the day, but we just want them to do it safely and maybe not as urgently as everyone always seems to think it needs to be.
And Jan, as you identify as an injured worker, and obviously I'll ask you to limit your comments to whatever you feel comfortable sharing. But I mean, can you talk a little bit about your experience as an injured worker?
Absolutely. And I am one of the rare ones who actually made it through the system and got back into work and back in to close to my classification, which is a rarity. And I clearly understand that that's a rarity. But I did. I worked at the University of Guelph, suffered a workplace injury in 1995. So I'm also one of the lucky ones that I was, not lucky in that I was injured, but lucky that I was into the system before the dramatic changes came. So I receive actually more benefits than someone who would be injured on the job now. But that's a whole other program that we could get into, the destruction of what was supposed to be a compensation system moving into an insurance system, right? Mm-hmm. Clearly, as an injured worker, I can tell you, as I just said, I'm one of the lucky ones. I escaped because in reality, all levels of government have basically legislated injured workers into poverty with the benefit packages, the support programs that are around them. I was able, a lot because of my union, be able to return to the work. And as Sarah said, I had folks inside of the union that were able to deal with a return to work that took into consideration that I was not just, a basic income unit, that I was a person that, had physical limitations, but that I was capable of doing a job and being part of, the workplace. But it is, I can clearly understand why workers, there was a period where I was cut off of WSIB while there was a challenge about the surgeries I went to go on. And if it hadn't have been for my family members, I don't know how my partner, my son, and I would have survived. I had no income. And it's pretty difficult when you have medical expenses, traveling expenses, to be able to do that. The system is clearly not there for a worker that is injured. The employer looks at it simply from a immediate cost factor, not the cost factor that's going to continue on over for years and years. And the employer gets to download some of their cost onto governments and onto the backs of injured workers by, the way that they fight against WSIB.
Mm-hmm. And Sarah, I think Janice is getting at, I think, a level of short-sightedness with management, with government, with even the workers themselves. And I'm sure you see this a lot, people who are like, well, I got to go to work. And even if I'm injured, I got to earn my paycheck. Because if I don't earn my paycheck, I lose my rent control housing. And then I'm on the street and I can't find anything because going into someplace new cost me $1,000 more than the rent I'm paying right now. And I imagine you see that a lot. People kind of feel trapped by the system. And that is typically where our labor unions come into play.
Definitely. It's so hard to talk to a worker. I think even, I know we're talking about day and morning, but just being injured in general or having a disease or a condition in Canada or Ontario, I don't know if I can say this, you're basically screwed. And I say that to members all the time. It's so hard because they have to, and it's a hard conversation to have with basically a stranger because you meet them during this process. And your question is like, how much longer do you need to work for to retirement? Do you even have a retirement plan? Do you have any money coming in? And, you know, and people are like, well, I have to work. But I'm like, but you're just causing just horrible pain and disfigurement to your body. And people have to make that decision. But unfortunately, in this province, if you choose to stop working or if you can't be accommodated, there's not much out there. The WSIBs, you know, they're non-economic loss awards. They're abysmal. And, you know, at best, we might get a severance package. And then you're basically on ODSP or you're on CPPD or CPP and old age education. And that's it. And then people ask, well, what about my benefits? And it's like, you know, if you have an allowed claim, you can get some money for just the work-related injury, but they don't do maintenance, of course, because why would they, you know, support workers beyond, you know, maximum medical recovery? Mm. But they, you know, they're pushed into this stream of being downloaded into the public services, and the WSIB, like Jan says, like I've been saying this for years, this is not a work centric system. It's not a compensation system. It's an insurance company. And if we look at it that way, we can navigate it a little bit better and, you know, make sure that, you know, the expectations of the workers are a little dampened down because there's just so little there to support them in mm-hmm. the end.
Mm-hmm. Janice, I want to lean on your seniority, if you don't mind me saying that. But you know, you've been at this in one form or another for years. What is the sort of the common misunderstandings that some people have about sort of the protections workers have, like in their own mind? Like, we assume that, you know, our systems work pretty good and people are well protected. And then they're confronted with a real reality that maybe not so much. How much confusion is there out there about sort of what people's rights are?
Well, there's confusion and there's stereotyping that goes on, right? Folks look at the injured worker, and the employer sets this up also, right? Because when a worker is injured in the workplace, the burden of that injury falls upon everybody in that workplace. And the employer doesn't do that appropriately, right? Of A, making sure that there's other workers that are covering off the duties, making sure that the duties are safe, bringing in somebody to check, like, what are they doing? What caused this injury, right? Actually dealing with it. So it becomes where workers are pitted against workers, because when one worker goes off injured, that increases the workload on other workers, which means they're going to get injured. And so this cycle just continues, and the employer just sees it as workers being really indispensable, right? Like they can just replace those workers. And again, it comes back down to, I mean, I remember when I found out at the University of Guelph, you know, students and workers, but students in particular were considered basic income units, right? And workers are basic expenditure units, right? So when we are an accounting line, how can that be any sort of system that is a health and safety system? How can that be about putting workers first, right? It is about a line in a budget, is what it's down to. And that line is, as we all know, budgets can be reported in any way that they can, because they're not really telling the cost of what happens to our whole system when we have an injured worker.
Yeah, budgets are a point in time. Usually it's a fiscal year, which doesn't really tell you the story of the impact over multiple years. Sarah, Janice, just, you know, talking about sort of workers being pitted against each other, and it sort of makes me think about, you know, your area, you know, your union and the workers you deal with, United Food and Commercial Workers. That's an industry that has seen a lot of difficulty in recruiting in the last few years. And I can't help but wonder if that is tied to a sense of that idea, workers being pitted against workers, not being adequately compensated for the work that they do. And you know, feeling like, as Janice was saying, you're a basic income unit.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's all stigma, right? Mm-hmm. Because we talk often about this, because, you know, when you have someone who has, you know, maybe it's a cast or crutches or a cane or a wheelchair, you know, your brain automatically goes to, oh, well, they're disabled. And I mean, I look at it as more differently abled, of course, because people can do many miraculous things with injuries. But the problem is, the biggest problem I find is the internal injuries, the invisible injuries, like mental health, like tendonitis, like, you know, irritable bowel syndrome, like these internal things that don't always present at the same time. And are visible. But when we deal with return to work, and again, this is like from, you know, union perspective, but we're also dealing potentially with return to work specialists from the WSIB, is this notion of like, you know, you got to try it, you know, because you got to get, you got to be paid. But then there's this, all of a sudden it's like the, you know, do things as tolerated, which is one of my evil things. I hate doctors writing on forms, because what's tolerated to the employer and their bottom line is a lot different than what it is for the injured worker. Right. But and then it's also things like, especially in our grocery retail, where it's, you know, it's like, just ask for help. And that's the accommodation. And it's like, but what ends up happening, as Janice was leading into, I mean, I guess I can give the example size of things, is that what ends up happening is, if you're in, say, the meat department, and you need help lifting heavy boxes, all of a sudden your coworkers magically disappear when the load comes in, you know, and then workers are like, it has to be put away. It's got to get in the freezers. It's got to get here. And they just work, and then they re-injure themselves. And it's just this, like Jess says, it's a cycle. It's a terrible, terrible cycle. And it's scary sometimes, like what people think. I was doing a return to work meeting in an industrial auto plant, and the worker had irritable bowel syndrome as well as carpal tunnel. And, you know, and they were doing these heavy brake work. They're making brakes for auto parts. And we're walking around with this return to work specialist, and we're seeing what other people do to see if it's an appropriate job. And I don't know if I'm allowed to swear, but, you know, this
by all means,
right in front of all of us, in front of the head of health and safety, in front of myself, they don't know I'm from the union, in front of the guy from the WSIB. And they're just like, I don't want to fucking cripple on my line.
Oh, wow.
And we're all just sitting there in shock going,
yeah,
whoa, you know, and then another woman turned around and says, I had the same problem and I'm fine. What's your problem? You know? And you're like, wow, you can't even empathize when you have the same issue. And it's sad that stigma is still out there. We're just not getting it. And like I said, it's on the employers. It's on the employers to provide a safe environment, and, you know, from harassment and bullying. Because I'll tell you, I mean, I've been doing this now for almost 9-10 years, and almost all of our claims start with a physical injury. And by the time we get to the actual appeal stage, because it does take a long time, we're then now dealing with a mental health issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because people are, you know, you're in chronic pain, and or you can't get back to work, or you're being harassed and bullied trying to return to work. It's just ridiculous. It's terrible how it's settled into this kind of, you know, a mire for injured workers. Like I said, you're basically screwed if you're injured in this province. And it's, you know, thankfully, you know, we get those with unions. I mean, I am mortified to when I think about people that aren't
absolutely unions. Yeah,
because, you know, we offer our service free of charge. It's we don't have to. We're not legislated in any collective agreement or law to offer this service to our members, but we just know it's the right thing. And it's completely free because it's within their dues, you know. But if you try to go to, like, if you're non-union and you go to, you know, I always call them ambulance chasers, but you know, an injured worker law firm or paralegal, they're taking over 30% of anything you get garnered back. Like,
it's ridiculous. Yeah.
So, you know, and unfortunately these workers need every single penny we can, you know, like rip out of the cold, dead hands of the WSIB.
Yeah. The thing about the lawyers you're talking about, you know, the ones you see on TV ads don't pay for themselves. Janice, Sarah used the word mire, and I think that's a pretty good word, because I was looking at some of the stats about people killed on the job in Canada. Unifor said there were close to 1,000 people last year killed on the job. I don't know if that was just them or general, but I feel like if 1,000 people were being killed by Boston Cream every year, we'd probably take action about it.
Absolutely. And yeah, the figures that we have is 2022 figures is the last complete data. And then remember, these are the ones reported through SIB, 993 deaths in Canada, and 317 of those were in Ontario, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it is, you know, there's one stat there that says that the number of injuries per year in Canada is 277,225 and that's reported. And some of those, you know, get divided into their fatalities. Some of them are critical incidences, and some of those are just incidences requiring medical attention. But in 2021, it was 1,081 workers were killed in workplace injuries that were reported. And the stat that the federal government had at that point was almost 5 workplace deaths every working day in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, do you hear about this on the news very often?
No. Right?
371 deaths, 317 deaths in Ontario in 2020. Can you name any of those folks?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No level of government, our municipal, our provincial, or our federal government, no one is paying attention to this, nor our employers.
Yeah.
Right? There is political will that is lacking, because this does not have to be this way, right? And particularly in this province, why are our numbers often staggeringly higher than other provinces with similar populations and similar types of workplaces, Quebec, BC, right? What is it? And now I think that it is absolutely imperative if we look, and I'm glad that Day of Mourning this year, we're switching and not switching, but one of the focuses is because we are actually in a climate crisis. And one of the things that people are not talking about is the impact on workers because of this climate crisis. And right now, the one issue, you know, that I've been working on with the ONDP is the issue around heat stress. There is nothing in our Occupational Health and Safety Act that deals with stress, with heat stress. We know that there have been deaths in this province and in this country because of heat. We suspect that there is probably going to be a lot more. At this point, we only have 25(2)(h), which is a part of the Occupational Health and Safety Act that says that the employer shall take every precaution reasonable for the safety of workers. So we unions have been trying to use that language to get some regulations around heat stress and what's going to happen with that, right? Mm-hmm. But this is workers' safety is paramount in the climate crisis, and yet nobody, and I would suggest even us as workers, our union leadership, we're not talking about the hazard that climate change, that the climate crisis actually does. And then what is our role? Because as health and safety activists, we believe in removing the hazard at the source, right? So then now what is our responsibilities as union and as labor to address the climate crisis in relationship to how it relates to the safety of workers?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, that's a bit of a tangent, but it's really been on my mind that workers are totally out of this discussion about the climate crisis in that way, in safety.
And I think your point is valid, because the firefighters up north who fight the forest fires, I mean, that is a practical matter of like hectares and hectares of forest going up in flames. But I mean, that is a labor issue. They are shorthanded. They're technically part-time.
Or volunteer.
They're volunteer. That's right. So, you know, that we kind of, there are issues that we think about a lot tend not to be labor issues. And I'm sorry, sir, I think you wanted to have something. Oh, no. Okay. Well, since you're up now, we've talked a lot about injuries on this pod. I think just, you know, as a matter of clarification, I think one of the things we kind of understand coming out of this is that whether you are injured on a job or killed on the job, sometimes, I mean, when you have 5 people in workplaces in Canada every day being killed, it seems like it's like a matter of luck. Like, injuries could be deaths under different circumstances. Like maybe if you're like a step closer to the skid that's falling, it doesn't just like hit you on the side. It crushes you. So we should be looking at injuries as like, I guess, I don't know, lucky. You were lucky. You could have been killed. And, you know, maybe that is, we should be looking at these things by the worst case scenario, not just like, oh, it's a bother because now this worker is injured.
I'm not really sure what to say to that. I mean, like, this is a funny way to look at it. I mean, I suppose that's like, if we try to look at it positively, yes. You know, the cup half empty, half full kind of idea. You know, it's like, well, you didn't die,
yeah.
You know, or you're not paralyzed. You're just, you know, sore, you know, but, I don't know. It always amazes me because I could have people with amputations or, you know, major crush injuries and they're happy and they're back to work within a couple of days. And then you could have someone who has like a bit of tendonitis in their shoulder and it's like, they won't work for months.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I guess everyone has a different pain threshold and, you know, every, you know, what's big to someone may not be big to someone else. My father taught me that when I was a kid, you know, like I was, you know, you're going through all these like terrible times and, you know, a friend comes up to you and goes like, I like a boy. And it's like, that's your issue. Like, and you know, and it's same here. It's like, you know, the level of pain, the level of the injury, it's still an injury at the end of the day. We had, and again, the prevention side of things, right? I think, you know, I'll go on a bit of a, if it's okay, I'll go on a bit of a tangent.
Please, yes.
Is, you know, is the actual the deaths on the job and the ugliness that actually is surrounded around that, because there was back in like 10 years ago, the WSIB was not properly funded. Like same with a pension plan, they had an unfunded liability that they needed to build, and of course they gave themselves about 10 years. It was supposed to go to about 2025, and they ended up filling the coffers by 2019, 2020, like 4 or 5 years early. And we're kind of like, well, hold on, how do you do that? You didn't increase the premiums because they've been frozen for 20 years. And so we know it's on the backs of the workers, all these denied claims, which is why I will have a full-time job for the rest of my life. you know, and it was just so disgusting. And then they were then legislated in, I think it was Bill 148. It was kind of hidden underneath a bunch of other really good stuff for workers, but it was kind of hidden in there and we couldn't object to it because of the rest of the stuff was actually decent, was that the WSIB then could determine what to do with any surplus that they had. So they had sort of a window threshold between, I think it's like 115% and 121%. So once they hit that threshold, they could then decide what to do with the money. And of course, you know, us as activists, we're like, put it into prevention, put it into health and safety, get it back to allow these claims for workers, you know, don't penny pinch on a few days loss of earnings, like pay them, increase the loss of earnings benefit from 85% to 90 or 100. You know, we ask for so many things.
Yeah.
And what did they do? They returned it to the employers.
Huh. Yeah.
And I think it was like $1.2 billion, something ridiculous like that. And you know, the problem I see is all these little, you know, gifts that keep going back to the employers, you know, like they have health and safety plans. If you have zero reporting, you know, you can get a bonus. And it's like, well, hold on. If you have zero reporting, it's because you're suppressing claims, to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And the workers will get a pizza.
And yes, if they're lucky.
If they're lucky.
Back to that word lucky. But the problem I have is that, like, when we talk about injuries versus killed, is if there's a program, and there has been in the past, I think it might even still exist, if there's a program that you have no lost time claims, you can get a premium back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But the problem is that if you go into work and the legislation, the Workers' Health and Safety Act says that if you are injured at work, the employer is responsible to pay you for the day of injury. So if you go to work, you'll get paid for that day, but you're not walking out because you've died. But a dead person doesn't have lost time.
Right.
So a worker could die with an employer in a year, and if there's no other lost time claims, they can still get a benefit or a bonus back.
Huh.
And I mean, how ugly that is so, it like, it makes my skin crawl just to think about it. And, you know, there are lots of policies that deal with survivor benefits and care for workers that are killed on the job, but it's not enough.
No.
And, you know, I mean, this is any injury like this or a death, it alters not just the injured workers' lives, it alters their families' lives. You know, having to deal with someone who's in chronic pain, you know, having to modify the house so that they can, you know, still do, you know, daily activities. You know, maybe they're working, maybe they're not. Like, it's everyone's life is altered. And it's something that we have to be, again, more empathetic about. And again, this is why we have this day. This is why we commemorate, you know, those that have been, you know, killed or injured on the job, right?
Yeah. So. Yeah.
And that number can be staggering, Adam. Like in 2021, there were 88,000 no lost time claims, but people had injuries and sought medical attention, but they didn't have any lost time. So that's not recorded any place. Those 88,000 injuries are not in the pool of stats that we have saying how big this problem is. It's like it doesn't exist. And there's this use of language, right, that they keep wanting to call it an accident, and we want to call it an injury or an incident. Because most of the, like, I would suggest the majority of these are not accidents, right? Is they were preventable, right? There was something, the system is allowing those to happen. And so the employers continue to use that word accident. And unless there's lost time, what does that mean? An injury didn't happen because there's no lost time? Mm. Like, that's what they're doing, right? They're changing the definition of what an injury is.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of those stories like from the 80s, like clubs in New York, because someone would overdose on, you know, in the club, and they would take them outside and then call the police or call an ambulance, because then you could say, well, no one's ever overdosed in the club when, you know, it's very cosmetic.
And there's also an issue, and it's happening at the University of Guelph right now. There's an issue when so a worker gets injured on the job. And then the death happens not immediately on the job, but afterwards, and can be related back to the incident, right? To the original injury. And then because it didn't happen at the time, it is like, well, who is actually investigating? And now the scene. Where we would say that there's a crime scene, right? To do is there a criminal negligent, right? That scene is gone. The scene where the person died could be their home, could be like thousands of miles from where the actual incident happened. Then there's like, okay, so who's actually responsible for this now? What police force is going to do, right? This investigation. And so there is a lot of problems with the system, because not every worker who is killed because of a workplace accident or incident, doesn't actually happen at that time. Mm. Right. And there's this separation. And it's the same as all of those that were missing because of chemical exposure, occupational diseases that die aren't dying in the workplace, but are dying outside of the workplace. They don't get recognized as workplace fatalities either.
Yep. Wow. Okay. That's a lot to think about. I mean, it makes you kind of understand and appreciate why we kind of take April the 28th out and recognize it. So Sarah, maybe to wrap up, can you talk a bit about what's planned on April the 28th locally? So if people want to take part.
Yeah, I think this is our third year that we have been back since COVID, and our favorite, we're a little spot in downtown Guelph that we are trying to overtake as the little Union Park is Goldie Mill. I guess it's on the south side. Of the music center, and that's where we actually have our memorial bench for Day of Mourning. We have our ginkgo trees, which I believe James might be able to help me with this one. The ginkgo tree, I think, represents memory and truth, so that we can remember those that have passed. And then, of course, last year we installed the soapbox in honor of Alan Peerskill. So again, we're trying to claim this little patch of land for our little labor speakers.
I think we have.
So we are meeting there on Sunday, April the 28th from, I believe it's 1 to 3 or 1 o'clock until we wrap. We have a few speakers coming in. I will be emceeing the event. I know Janice is speaking. We've got someone from ONIWIG, which is the Ontario Network of Injured Workers Group. We have the Workers' Health and Safety Center speaking. And if I've forgotten, I think Mike Schreiner is hoping to be able to make it and speak as well. And we always open up the floor a little bit too, because like Janice was saying, things aren't reported. We don't hear about deaths and injuries in the news. I think it was last year, this wonderful family came up to us and said, can, you know, we speak? And because their father and husband and brother were all there, you know, they were there to say, hey, he died on the job and no one was talking about it. So that's heartbreaking. But so we always kind of leave a little moment open, because, you know, people will come out that we don't expect or we didn't know to reach out to. So it's always heartwarming to be able to help, you know, stand by them and support them in this loss.
Absolutely. I try to do a little something to mark the day on the podcast every year, just because I think it is so important, and to let people know that as a worker, you do have rights, and one of those rights is to protect yourself and to protect yourself from injury and harm on the job. Everyone deserves a safe workplace. So thank you, Sarah. Thank you, Janice, for taking some time out today to remind us of that. It's appreciated.
Thank you for doing this piece, Adam. It's important that the message gets out there. I really, really appreciate you taking the time to do it and your thoughtful questions.
Yes.
Thank you. And once again, that was Sarah Neath and Janice Folk Dawson. As you heard, the local commemoration for the National Day of Mourning is on Sunday, April 28th at 1 p.m. in Goldie Mill Park off Cardigan Street, and that will be followed by a reception at Diana's downtown on Upper Wyndham. You can also follow the hashtag Day of Mourning, and remember that's with a U, on social media, and you can stay on top of all the events and all the advocacy that comes along with the issues behind worker safety on the job across Canada. And you can also follow the Guelph and District Labour Council on Facebook or at their website, guelphlabour.ca. And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. You can download the Guelph Politicast every Wednesday from Apple, Google, TuneIn, and Spotify. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you'll get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. You can follow Guelph Politico on social media at Guelph Politico on Twitter and at Politico Guelph on Facebook. You can follow me personally at Adam A. Donaldson on Twitter and Instagram, or send me an email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com if you'd like to help financially support the work of Guelph Politico. You can get all that information at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And finally, for all the latest local political news, you can check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of this show for you next week. And until then, see you next time.